Well, Briarcliff is a place where MU and KU is welcome and nobody is perfect and anything is possible. Right? Is this the, which side is this? Is this MU or KU? Is this MU or KU, John? I'd like to stir things up before I create unity, you know. How many of you ever have taken a long trip and it went perfectly? You know, just everything worked out smoothly as can be. You know, when Charlene and I got out of seminary, we decided we'd take, the president and the dean was going to lead a tour around the world. And so we actually borrowed a little money and we had, I think our daughter was 7 years old then. And I know our parents thought we were absolutely crazy. We left our daughter with them. And we were gone for a month and a half on that trip around the world. And I thought we'd already paid our money and I was so excited about doing it. And then, got to think about all that we had to do, you know, they gave us vaccinations for every country in the world. You know, I just felt like over and over and over those shots given to us. And then I got to think about what do we do, what will happen if we don't make it back? And our seven-year-old daughter, so then we had to make out a will if we died. And I thought, boy, this is getting to be rugged here. We haven't even got on the plane yet. And then it all went pretty well, but then we got to Russia. And we were one of the first tourists into Russia in those days. And they were very, very skeptical of us, and we were certainly skeptical of them. And I noticed when we were going through customs into Russia, I'd just been to Bangkok. I'd bought a big sword about this long. I planned to bring it back and put it on my desk. I thought that would help out if I had any problems. And and I had it in my suitcase, and Charlene kept saying, you know, you really need to send that thing back home, because we were mailing a lot of stuff back. And I said, well, yeah, I'll go. I'll do it. And then, lo and behold, when we filled out all of our paperwork on the plane getting ready to go into Russia, it said, do you have any weapons on you? Okay. I went and talked to Dr. Seitz, and I said, hey, what should I put here? I've got this long sword. And he said, oh, I don't think there'll be a problem. Just put you don't have any. I thought, I don't know to trust you or not. So when we got into there and they were going through customs, they were scared to death of anything that was religious at all. And when they'd open up a suitcase and they'd see any kind of religious Christian material, they'd shake it in your face and throw some of it away. And I saw some take their Bible and they'd shake it in the face of the people and say, if you take this into our country, make sure you take it back out. Oh, what are they going to do when they see that sword? I could become a permanent resident of Russia. And they were opening up every suitcase. And so I just threw my suitcase on the belt. And lo and behold, he said, right on, right on. And I said, right on, Lord. I didn't have to open it up. So I'm back in America, not in Russia, because I didn't have to open it back up, you know. So you get sick on those trips. And there was times I'd said, you know, if there's any place I could catch a ride home, I'd do it. I'd have bailed out of that trip. So any trip, salvation that God gives us is a journey. It's a long journey. And there'll be times in that journey that people want to think, you know, I've had it. I don't think I can make it. And even want to bail out. I'm not going back to church anymore. I'm not going to try to have a quiet time anymore. It doesn't help anything in my life. This is a painful, bitter experience right now. Where is God? So we see all of that. So what do you do when you, first of all, when they were set free from bondage and experienced this freedom, the first thing they experienced is the wilderness. So what do you do? I'm going to give you five things that we'll learn from this lesson this morning. Number one is trust God in the wilderness, chapter 15, verse 22. Then Moses made Israel set out from the Red Sea. Now they'd been set free, see? Set out from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days, only 3 days into the wilderness. And there they found no water. And all of a sudden, they had this freedom. But this freedom led into wilderness. How many times do we find people that experience salvation and they know Christ came into their life and forgive their life and all their sins, and things got worse? That's not uncommon. You know, some years ago when Mother Teresa wrote and they published some of her private writings in a book called Come to My Light, one thing she says in there that shocked people: in my soul, I feel just that terrible pain of loss, of God not wanting me, of God not being God. And people looked at her life and they said, we could never imagine that was going on inside of her. We're really good at putting on a front many times going to church. But down inside, there's an emptiness, there's a loss, there's bitterness, there's the wilderness experience. Remember what happened to Jesus? Right after he was baptized, what happened? What was the next step? The scripture says the Spirit of God led him into the wilderness. Strange, isn't it? Now he had just been baptized. This is my beloved Son, who am I well pleased with him. Now into the wilderness. The psalmist over and over would say things like this. This is Psalm 10:1. Why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? I'm in trouble. Where are you? It seems that God does that over and over in the scriptures. That's not uncommon. And it has a purpose to it. There's a refining of silver that makes it pure. I remember we used to have an old red rooster, and it happened to be a fighting red rooster. I don't know if you've ever seen these red roosters. Mine, they're vicious. And we had one, and I don't know why we didn't have him for lunch, but we had one. And every time I'd go outside as a kid, that red rooster would come after me, and I would run, and I would cry, and I would scream, and I'd run to the house and close the door and into safety. And I got where I was living in a great indoor life rather than outdoor life, you know. My dad got so tired of me whining and running that when I was running to the house one day and that rooster was right behind me, Dad locked the door. You never saw such a fight in all your life. I kicked, and I don't know which squawked the loudest, but I put that old red rooster on the run. You know what happened after that? My dad knew. I would walk outside, and the red rooster would run. I was set free. I was set free. A lot of times God is not forsaking us in the wilderness. He wants to run us through sometimes even a challenge that he knows the outcome will bring good. So trust God is the first step in the wilderness. Second is guard against grumbling. Chapter 15, verse 23. And when they came to Marah, Marah means bitter. When they come to Marah, they could not drink the water. I can just imagine they're going, they see an oasis there in the future and the distance, and they run like crazy to get there. And when they take a drink, it is bitter. And therefore, it is named Marah. And the people grumbled against Moses. We can't drink this water. So the second thing is that don't grumble. Does grumble help in anything? Does grumble help anything? They'd only gone 3 days now, and this is a law you can just bank on. Life will have bitter times. Bitter times. Now, grumbling, let me show you what grumbling will produce. Here are the benefits of grumbling, just so you know, in case you look at them here. Grumbling ignores God's potential. It also jumps to bad conclusions, produces bad judgment, sees problems, not possibilities. It's hard to see the possibilities when you're grumbling. It produces the self-pity, rebellion, dissatisfaction, can create depression anxiety, our anger. That's a pretty costly road to travel down. And so grumbling helps nothing. We were keeping our grandson, the youngest one, this week, and he was grumbling about something that Charlene wouldn't let him do. And he said, "I used to think you were the best grandma in the world, but I was totally mistaken." "I thought you were the greatest God in the world." And then sometimes you think, I was totally mistaken. What do you do? What do you do with those times that you are prone to grumble? You install an anti-grumbling software. You know what an antivirus software does? It catches the grumbling. It catches the bad stuff. And we need to have that anti-grumbling software in our system that when the grumbling starts, it filters it out. Then you have to replace it with something. You have to replace it with gratitude and with grace, you know. Remember the grace that God has extended to you, extended out. And to serve. We've long learned that one of the best ways to get through a bitter time is helping someone else. We learned that from AA. The part of the process of working through a dependency in alcohol is helping somebody else. One of the ways to work it through grief, and grief can be very bitter. And grief can be the loss of anything. It's not just the loss of someone in death. It can be any kind of bitterness that you lose something very precious to you. And it is a profitable thing to serve to help someone else. Carl Menninger, that founded the Menninger Foundation and Institute, said, when you've come to those places like that of bitterness and heartache and depression, one of the best things is get out and find somebody to help. So it is important for us during those times not to grumble, but then to turn that into something that is very, very helpful in serving and helping somebody else. Now, these next two things that I want to mention are kind of, they're challenging, but also they can be devastating. One is to never give up, and the other one is be careful with the life of ease. So number three is don't give up following God. You're in Mara. That is beside the spring that has bitter water. But keep on going. Find someone to serve. Keep on moving ahead. Don't drop out. And then, verse 27, and then they came to Elim, where there was 12 springs of water, 70 palm trees. It was like Hawaii on our trip around the world. When we got to Hawaii, I said, let's just stay here. I don't want to go around the world. I want to just stay here. We're going to have to leave this beach. We're going to have to leave all of this. I don't want to. And it's a very dangerous. You know, one of the greatest tests is not the bitterness in your life. The very greatest test is success in your life. If you can survive success, you can survive most anything. Because successful times are the times that you forget God. Bitter times is the time you think God has forgotten you. But successful times are the times that we are prone to forget God. And so when they were in Elim, God didn't allow them to stay there very long. Because God had a love for them that he wanted to produce character in them fit for the promised land. He was taken to the promised land, but he knew he had a lot of character to build into them before they ever got to the promised land. So maybe you are in a bitter time right now. Don't give up. You know how far it was from Marah to Elam? Less than 10 miles. You're closer than you think to fresh water and luscious fruit. Don't throw in the towel. Don't quit. Just keep on going and keep on going. There'll be times of great refreshing times and there'll be times of drought. So don't give up. Number four, don't get too comfortable in Elam. Because Elam is as much of a test as the wilderness. Success is as much of a test as those bitter times. So it says here in chapter 16 now, they set out from Elam. And I don't know, I would imagine they would say, why go any farther? We like it here. This is great. They set out from Elam, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness. And what was the last part of it? And Israel grumbled again. They're back in the grumbling stage because they've had to leave a beautiful paradise of Elam and move out. There's something about it when we get comfortable in any kind of situation. You want to stay in Hawaii. This is always a challenge for every small group that we have. It's a small group, you know, you want people to feel real close to one another, and it's sort of a catch-22. The closer that you get to one another in that group, the more difficult it is for a new person to come in or for you to multiply and start a new group. Is that not true? You get comfortable in that. You don't want to go there. I had a guy one time said, I was telling him, you know, I had some new people go into a group and they just, no one talked to them much and they just felt like they weren't welcome. And he said, well, send them to our group. They won't feel that way there. And I said, I'm sorry to tell you, that's the very group they came to. What? See, we don't get aware of how custom and how comfortable we are coming in here. We forget the people that are here this morning that this is your first time here. Sometimes it'd be like you going to a mosque and think, what will happen in there? And so a lot of times that we forget our comfort, and the more comfortable we are at Briarcliff, the more comfortable we are, the more in danger we are of closing out the rest of the world. Can I say that again? The more comfortable we are in worship and in our groups, the more comfortable we get, the more endangered we are of closing others out. We're not aware of that. We don't understand that. But that's where they were. They had that kind of comfort there, and we don't want to change. I wrote this down. I've looked at this a number of times. John Gardner, when he's Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, said this, total satisfaction is a kiss of death. Total satisfaction is a kiss of death. By the mid-30s, and that's what caught my attention because that's kind of where I am. By the mid-30s, most people have stopped acquiring new skills and new attitudes in any aspect of their life. Should I have everyone over 30 to stand with me? Satisfaction, total satisfaction is the kiss of death. When you once get comfortable at Briarcliff, you are in danger. I've found that it's healthy for me if I'm always at the edge of a challenge that is not comfortable. It's kind of a circle here that if I go beyond that, it's too much stress in my life, but I can't stay below that in the very comfort zone. I've got to always be living out there close to the edge. That's why I came to Briarcliff. I don't want to get comfortable. I need a challenge. I don't want to vegetate spiritually. So there's always that danger of getting too comfortable at Edom. Number five is don't make the journey alone. Moses' father-in-law was Jethro. Jethro came into town to check and see how Mo was doing. And he said, "Hey, Mo, what you're doing is not good." He said, "Look for able," this is verse 21, "look for able men from the people who fear God and are trustworthy and that hate bribes, and place those over other people there and divide them up into hundreds and thousands and right on down to smaller groups. Make it like a church. You know, you have the multitude here on Sunday, and then you have the smaller groups down. And then in a smaller group, I don't know if you've done this or not in your small group, but the accountability in that group comes when you have, in a small group, say of a dozen, then you have two or three people together, accountability in that. If your group has not done that, it forms some way of accountability in that group. And that's the way that he set that up. And said, "Hey, Mo, it's not good that you're trying to do this all by yourself." Charlene and I, as I've told you, work with a number of churches all over the country and in Canada. And right now working with one in Toronto. And you know, the biggest challenge in working with the churches is the staff. Because they don't want to let go of doing things. You know why? You know the average size of a church in America today? The average size of a church in America today? Less than 100. Why is that? Because about 100 is what one person can do as a pastor all by himself. And he can lead that. But unless he comes to the point of knowing how to develop others, he's sunk. It will stop right here and not go any farther. And Jethro knew that unless Moses would bring some people alongside him, he was not going to make it. The Christian life and this journey that we're on is not meant to go alone. You know, the best illustration I know is a cornfield. You put one grain of corn in the ground, and that's all, and that stalk comes up, and how much will it produce? Nothing. Until you have it in rows, and they can pollinate one another. You and I are not made for this journey alone. We need one another. So look in chapter 18, verse 22. He says, "They will help you carry the load." There are going to be times that you are overloaded and someone else can join with you, especially in your small group, and help you carry the load. Making the task easier for you. You'll be able to endure the pressure. So let somebody else get close enough. And it's hard to get that close to everyone in a group like this in the auditorium here. But in your small group, that's the reason why it's so important for you to be in a small group. That you have people that can rally around you. And especially in that small group, if you have two or three people that you're really close to enough for accountability, then that can bring strength in your life. And we need that. The Bible says that each one, this is Ephesians chapter 4, verse 16, each as each part does its own special work. In other words, every one of you have a special work to do to make the body strong. And each one that does that special work, and you have a special work, like no one else, special work, it helps the other parts grow so that the whole body is healthy and grows and full of love. We need that as a body to help us grow stronger. We need one another. We in America love independence. We love our car. Some of you, your family, and there's a number of you here that from your family, there was two or three cars came. When you go to work, everybody likes their car. You know, we love our independence. We don't want to rely on anyone. But when it comes to survival, in this journey called salvation, we must have one another to be healthy. And that one another has to be serving and helping one another. Question: how are you helping someone else? How are you serving someone else? How are you making a difference? Roll up your sleeves and find a place. You say, I don't know what I can do. We will help you. Go to discover your design. Come and let us know. Try some things out. We are the body. A young man by the name of Mark Hill wrote a song when he was doing youth ministry, and he wanted to try to teach the kids, and he wrote the song as a training tool. And he wanted to help them understand more about the church, because he wanted the students to know it wasn't all about them. So if we are the body, then how are the arms reaching? How's the hands healing? How are the feet moving if we are the body? He wrote the song, and it's not too singable until you come to the chorus. And we're just going to sing the chorus. But I want you to look at the words before we even try to sing it. Here's what he was teaching the kids. But if we are the body, the body of Christ, that's the church. If we are the body, why are the arms reaching? Are your arms reaching out to help somebody? Is our arms, in the Fall Fest, we're going to have a lot of arms reaching out into our community. Why aren't the hands healing, touching people that are hurting? You can make a difference when somebody's hurting. You say, well, I'm hurting myself. One of the best things will help you through that hurt is help somebody else. Why aren't these words healing? You can give some very encouraging words to somebody that helps heal their hurt. And if we are the body, why aren't our feet going? Why aren't our feet going? Going to someone that's not in church. Going to someone in need. Going to someone that does not know Christ. Why is His love not showing? Why is our love not showing? He goes on to say, as he would talk to the kids, he said, you know, the people in our world pretty well know what the church is against. We've not let them know what we're for. In some way, the world has to see that we are the body that is for them, not against them. Would you agree that most of the world looks at the church and Christians of what we are against rather than what we're for? If we are the body, then he said, why aren't the arms reaching? We're going to sing that. But before we do, I'd like for you to just bow. And let's ask God to make us a body with arms that are reaching, with hands that are healing hurts, with feet that are going, with words that encourage and bring help to hurt. Why isn't our love showing? Why would people in the world look at the church and think, well, that's all what they're against? Why wouldn't they see a love that you have to flow through us? God, help us at Briarcliff to have hands that are reaching out into our community. Help us to have feet that are going and hands that are healing. As we sing this, let it just remind us that we're on a journey, we need one another, and we're here to make a difference in the world for Christ's sake. Amen.